Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live a good life and to create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social, conscious, and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this episode of Edgy Ideas. Today we have a very special guest, Chris Yates. Chris is Chief Talent Officer at Ford Motor Company. Previously, Chris was General Manager of Learning and Development at Microsoft, Chief Learning Officer and Head of People and OD for Caterpillar, and he served in senior roles at HSBC and American Express. Chris also is a co-author of two books titled Share and Rewire. And Chris is a Queen's Park Rangers football fanatic. Chris, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. How are you?
Very well. Hello, Simon. Nice to talk to you.
Good. Chris, we're going to talk today about from the barricades to the boardroom. Do you want to just tell us a bit about your background? Give us a bit of history to go on.
Sure. So my family is originally from Guyana. I was born in West London. Hence the first of the QPR references that may or may not come up. Studied psychology, did my master's in occupational organizational psychology at Leicester, then in London. I thought I was going to get into the clinical side, and I was really interested initially in looking at work in prisons, and thought I'd go into the clinical side, to be honest, but I found myself doing, I guess, occupational psychology, worked for a number of corporates, as you've called out, focusing on OD roles. And it's a funny thing that the title, Barricades to Boardrooms, I got an offer from Microsoft years ago, and when I was at American Express, and I ended up staying at American Express, and they got me a very good corporate coach. And she put together like, I had a 1-year plan because I was seen as a bit rough around the edges to be for doing the job that I was doing at the time. And she titled it From the Barricades to the Boardrooms because I'd always seen myself as a kind of revolutionary. And I think I've never quite totally sat easy with sitting in the corporate world. It's funny at football and things like that, when I meet new people, people joke and say, yeah, Chris has a corporate job. And people are like, really? So there's, in my social circles, there's not too many people who have corporate gigs. And I still have to pinch myself sometimes that somehow for the last 20 something years, I've ended up actually working in sort of boardrooms, conference rooms. I guess my other reflection is just how powerful corporations are today, and somehow it's kind of settled with myself that that's where I've ended up. But it was it's been a journey.
It's been a real journey. I mean, I've known you for, I don't know, maybe 12 years or something. We met in HSBC when we were doing some work together, and I mean, you've got a phenomenal CV working at the highest levels in these vast companies, and it is a real journey you've been on. Why do you think I know you're very values led, and you're very, like you say, you started off kind of very socially committed, and that stayed with you. What power do you think these big organizations have at the moment in society?
Oh, that's so interesting. Multiple. I mean, I could talk for an hour just on that question alone, Simon. I'll just run through a few things. So many aspects of our lives, in terms of the choices of media that we watch. I'll stop on the media for a second. I remember talking to a friend who worked at Reuters, and they said, for anyone sort of, let's say the 6 o'clock news, 10 o'clock news, they have thousands of hours of footage, and they pick which 30-second clip they want to show on the news time. And that 30-second clip shapes public opinion. That's immense power out of thousands of hours of potential footage of everything going on in the world. How do you choose which 30-second story to tell? That's a massive influence in our lives. And you get down to the quality of the food, the choices of food, the choices of fashion, the quality of the air, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that side of it. I think, one of the analogies I often use, and we might come back to this, is that in ancient times, you know, the biggest buildings in the city were the palaces, And, you know, even if you go back to the village, the biggest house was the kind of chief, the chieftain's house. And it was difficult to get into the chieftain's house, the kind of guards around it, the guards around the palace. And then, you know, organized religions, you know, at some point became very strong. And you had the monasteries or the temples, and it was very difficult because you had the temple guards and the palace guards. And those were the big buildings in the cities. But if you go to any major city in the world, then the palaces are kind of a tourist attraction. The churches are now being used as offices or something else like that. But the biggest buildings in the city are the corporates. And most citizens can't get through the security. So those of us who work in this corporate world, and especially in the types of roles we do, I think we have a very privileged role to influence and help shape the society around us by, in many ways, where the power sits. I mean, my last point is that the produce of many corporations is more powerful than the GDP of many countries in the world. Especially the biggest corporations today. And finally, the obvious piece that's in the news a lot, the power of corporations around the world to shape, you know, the politics, the society, the trade. So I think we sit in a very privileged role, and we should all have more confidence and values about, you know, what we teach, because in the work that we do, we shape the leaders who in many ways run society the ways that the kings or the priests or the temples did. So, yeah, I think we're very privileged to be working in this space.
Yeah, very privileged. And it's so important. I mean, I was talking to a colleague recently, and they were asking me about, did I miss being a social activist? And my early life was as a family therapist, working directly with people. And there's some things I do miss, but I said to them, like, you know, if we want to really impact on environmental change and social justice, then we have to kind of get the big corporates and then the big organizations kind of to make those changes, because that is where power is held, just as you said, really.
No, I'd agree. I think outside of even the big corporates, you know, more recently through some board work I've done, I think the other aspect is around family-owned businesses. I think the majority of people actually work in family-run businesses, not just the big corporates. And again, I forget the number, but it's the majority of people around the world work in actually family organizations. And many of us are working in family-run businesses, which maybe don't have the scale, but again, either at the local community level and just in terms of impact of your local community and the lives people leave, those organizations are immensely powerful at a different level as well.
And what do you think you bring as an outsider working on the inside? Do you consider yourself a maverick, or how would you consider your role?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, one of the reflections, and I talked about this a bit in Share, is that I think the outside press, you know, when we think about corporations, we often have this story of there's this, elite corporate people who've gone to the Ivy Leagues or the kind of blue chip education and all that. But in reality, you know, as I think about the colleagues that I work with day to day, many of us, one generation or in our lifetimes, you know, coming from if not poverty, from very humble means. And I think at an individual level, that's not really understood as much maybe by the outside world. I remember taking my own kids back to Guyana in the house I grew up in. And they stood out looking at the house. It was kind of a ruin with trenches around it what would be called, I won't swear, but one of those, you know, poor countries of the world, Guyana. And they looked at me and said, how did you get from this house where you grew up to the house we were living in Seattle in one lifetime? And as I think about many of the people that I work with, you know, their grandparents were farmers or, worked on the line in a manufacturing piece, or, you know, did very what's called blue collar manual labor. But their children or grandchildren are now holding immense power, you know, in the world. And that's a real opportunity that the world has brought recently. And I wonder sometimes about, you know, tapping into that conscience or humanity for those individuals is definitely an opportunity, because it gives a perspective.
Yeah, huge perspective, and you know, we can't ignore privilege that most people in the positions go through Ivy League. They do their kind of MBA at Harvard. There's a a normative way to the top, and then there's a other way to the top, isn't there? And it's getting those other voices heard, which is so important. What about being in a black person in a mainly white boardroom? That must have been most of your experience. Is that right?
Yes, that's an interesting one. You know, it was only in the last year, I think I went to a meeting for the first time where, and I remember this meeting so clearly, there was a meeting of about eight people and five of us were black. It was actually at Microsoft. And I stopped the meeting and said, this is the first meeting I've ever been in where there are five out of eight of us were black. And all of us laughed, but there was actually a huge moment. There's something funny about that. I mean, yeah, so absolutely, yes. And often the only people that you would see are generally the cleaners or the people who are bringing your tea and coffee. And there's something about, you know, the affinity of that. Someone's telling you, you know, fix your tie, tuck your shirt in, giving you an extra lump of sugar, an extra bit of chocolate, of always feeling supported by the black community, even if it's just the office cleaner or the something, people saying, oh my God, brother, like you've actually made it into there. I remember one story sitting in the elevator going up. There's an executive floor at HSBC, which kind of takes you to the top tier of that big building in Canary Wharf. And I get in the lift, and if you're getting in the lift and going up, you're only going to the executive floor. And there's another black colleague gets in. We look at each other like, who are you? You know, I've never seen anyone else black going up to the top floor. We introduce each other and we're still in touch. And he's the head of one of the senior risk leaders. And I remember it was like a shock, like, hey, there's another one coming in. And it's interesting. There's a couple of things. That's a great question, Simon, because it gives you a perspective and ease, because it means that, you know, my wife's family is from Flint, Michigan. Which, as you might know, is an absolutely devastated town, you know, by the pullout of the factories there. Absolute, you know, for a very, you know, developed country, Flint is an example of absolute poverty and deprivation right now. And I've spent, you know, time in Flint, time with family in the West Indies. And yet, on the other hand, I'm mixing in boardrooms and going to, you know, things in the City of London or Wall Street and things like that, and everything in between, but the football matches. So I think somehow the being black gives you this fluency, this ease of being able to relate to multiple places at the same time, which I'm not sure everybody else does. So I've never looked upon it as a kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but I've always used it as an opportunity to bring perspective, to tell stories, and drive awareness where I can. I feel very privileged to be able to have access to multiple areas of society, if that makes sense. And you're the same. I mean, you and I have traded a lot of stories. You must have the same thing coming from the background you did in Bristol, Simon, no?
Yeah, I mean, being working class, I guess being black is different, but being working class, I'm very aware that my voice and when I talk too fast, a Bristol accent, nobody in the international room can understand me, and I have to be told to slow down. And the idea of people around me, they're so entitled. There's an experience of being entitled, and I'm a bit like you. I always feel a bit shocked. What am I doing here? Should I really be here? It's not exactly imposter syndrome, because I feel confident and I feel engaged. But there's always an otherness there, and it gives you a way in, a way of looking and a way of thinking and a different experience. And I always feel like I'm a bit of an anthropologist in the workplaces I go to, because I always look from that third position. I don't kind of feel wholly part of it. And I kind of take a third position and I look in from somewhere else. And I think that's very helpful, actually.
Yeah, that's great. And I think going back to the point of saying that so many of us who work in the corporate realm actually don't come from the imagined privileged backgrounds I think that's something to tap into, you know, as a question, because I think one of the realities is that everyone is feeling that imposter syndrome. Even the people who went to the so-called, Silver Spoon, Ivy League background, there's a different pressure on them to kind of perform, to be something. And so, you know, you often got this room of a room full of actors, almost everybody playing this role, but everyone in some way feeling, should I be here? And even those people who you assume coming with a voice of arrogance or confidence, as you tap into that, you know, they're the ones sometimes who will check in going, was that all right? You know, they'll ask the question because, you know, there's a thing about our humanity where we all need the reassurance to feel we belong. You know, that belonging thing is so important.
I think that's very helpful. I mean, when I transitioned from being a family therapist working with really the most urban deprived young people in Liverpool, it was devastating in the 1980s, kind of unemployment, a bit like the Rust Belts in America now. And it was I was working really with very impoverished people. I'd never seen such poverty. And then within 3 or 4 years, I transitioned to being working with executive education in big companies, and it was a huge change for me. And I assumed there was this entitlement. And then I started to coach people. And in my coaching book, I write about the coaching confessional. And it's these very senior executives who I thought were so confident, so entitled, would always confess to me. They'd always kind of see me as someone they could open up to. And they'd tell me their personal stories. And like you say, from whatever background they came from, there was always some feeling of struggle just in their lives. In some way, and they could be hugely successful. Their outward appearance would be very, very confident, and yet they share with you kind of insecurities and anxieties. And it's very moving for me that, you know, everybody's human, aren't they? Everybody kind of that has shared experiences.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, you reminded me of something. We had a conversation, I think, about a year ago now. Actually, no, it was less than a year. But I think it was after some of the recent. After the George Floyd murder, I think it was Kyra and I were chatting with you, and we were talking. You were introducing the idea of containment. That for those of us, and probably many of the people listening to, I guess, a podcast like this, you know, one of the roles we play is creating that space, that sacred space, that confessional, that moment where it's safe to be totally authentic and talk. And, you know, one of the things I've used that a lot. I've talked about that in the last 9 months, because and I'm kind of dipping into the whole COVID experience and the social unrest, that one of the most difficult things has been to create a new space of where people feel safe to be authentic. And in many ways, this whole digital experience has accelerated that and made it more difficult at the same time. Because, you know, right now we're both having this conversation, not in an office somewhere, but we're doing it. I'm doing it in kind of, you know, in my spare bedroom. You're doing it from a space in your house. And in some ways, we're having more authentic conversations because we're in our home space. But then we're also having, you know, relative strangers visit into our space. And so creating space just to have dialogue about how are you doing, checking in, who are you? There's never been a greater opportunity, but it's never in some ways seemed more difficult at the same time. But it definitely seems to be the need for people to be able to step in that space and have honest conversations. I think there's a lot more loneliness, you know, because of everything that's happened this year, built on everything you were just saying.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, there's a massive amount of loneliness. And I mean, I'm really tapping into this pandemic has amplified what was already there, but it really has amplified it. And that sense of alienation, loneliness, in even people in the busy workplaces, I mean, people are just, I mean, busyness is often a cover for loneliness, I think, and alienation. Like if you stop, you get this wave of existential, like, what am I doing? Who am I? So people just kind of keep running on the treadmill. But I think COVID has made people stop, and it's really surfaced those feelings. You and I, Chris, we share football. We share faith. Tell me about faith and football. How they kind of influence your life and your life at work.
Oh wow, that's a big question.
Go for the big ones.
That's a big question to go ahead. You know, I'll start with faith. That's a great for faith and football. That's almost another podcast conversation, isn't it? There's a couple things there that kind of resonate immediately. There's something about faith, which is it gives you a community. It allows you it creates that space sometimes for a dialogue. I think one of the purposes of faith is to give us a third space And I think that comes in many forms today, either in the traditional organized religions, or I think some people find that kind of spirituality through practices like yoga or meditation and different things. But I think it is tapping into an other energy other than just the day to day. And it's a moment for pause, for reflection, to get back into what are your values and what's most important. And it's that grounding moment where, with so much chaos around us, you know, right now and through our lives, it's the moments where we purposefully need to stop and think what's really important. Because if you can live a life, I believe, where you're tapping into what you believe in, there's nothing more important. Because you know, we get one chance at this life, and looking back on our lives, if we're able to say that at the big moments we made the right choices that we're prepared to live with. And I've had a couple of critical career moments where I've said, you know, I'm going to choose the harder road because I think it's the right thing to do. It's the right ethical choice. And that, in many ways, comes down to my faith. It's kind of like, you know, at the day when I meet my maker, I want to be able to say, I think I made the right things. And I hopefully did more good than harm. And I tapped into that in a big way. And it's funny, I think it's just before we were preparing for this, I was sharing with you that 3 years ago, almost to the minute of this podcast, I was actually doing a piece of work in Israel. And I happened to visit Jerusalem, and we went to the tomb of Jesus and the Wailing Wall and different things. That was a profound moment for me in tapping into the energy of the place and seeing that. And I guess moving on to football, there's something about the football side, which is about creating community, I think. And, you know, coming over from the West Indies as like the shock of England in my early teenage years, coming from a single parent family, you know, brand new into the UK, football for me actually created an immediate tribal allegiance of being accepted, because you're immediately okay. There's a story. I hate talking too much, but there's a story I'll share. It really resonates with me in the first book, Rewire, which is around there's one that I sneak out of my mum's house. I'm like 12 years old, and I go to a Fulham QPR game. It's away at Fulham's ground. I've never been before. It's raining, and you know we still had free travel, so I get across the city. And my mum doesn't know where I am. To this football match, and I realize I don't have enough money to get in. So I'm in this alleyway next to a football ground. It's the game's kicking off and it's raining, and I'm like wretched. And three skinheads walk up to me, and I'm like, and I'm about to get a beating or worse. And I'm sniveling, and they walk up to me and they're like, you know, like, oi, oi, N-word, you know. And I'm about to get a hiding in my life. And they go, one of them goes, so what's the matter? And I'm like, I can't get on the ground. They go, which team are you? You Fulham or QPR? And I say, I'm QPR. And they pay for me to get in, buy me a cup of tea and a sausage roll. And, you know, I'm like, I'm their little nigger. So if you think about that, these are people with swastikas and whatever tattooed. At that moment, following the right blue and white, the hoops, was more important than the racial stuff. And I was accepted because I was part of a tribe. There's lots of filters there about community, belief, and who we are and who not is. And at that moment, it was really interesting to me as a thing for life that being a QPR fan at that moment was more important than being black, even for someone with swastikas tattooed on their hand.
Yeah, that's a powerful story indeed, yeah. Yeah, the tribalism of football and the community. And I used to think about I was very disappointed when they got all-seater stadiums, because being on the terraces, standing, hugging and jumping was a really bonding experience, wasn't it?
Oh, hugely. I read my diary sometimes from the 80s. I kept a diary every day. My whole focus was the week was towards Saturday, and then debriefing Saturday. That was like my whole diary experience. I think I was, it was interesting. I don't think I discovered girls, for instance, until late into my teens, because all I thought about was football. But for me, at least, honestly, having that allegiance probably kept me on a better path than not having that, because it gave me a little bit of purpose, a pattern, something to do with. There's something I think about, particularly young males who don't have, say, strong father figures, family structures, you know, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
In a way, it's going to sound strange, but being part of a football gang in many ways saved me, because it gave me an adjacent community, an adjacent family where you feel you belong, you feel you're part of something. You feel a sense of security or even strangely purpose in your life.
And you carry that identity with you today. I mean, if I come and visit you at Microsoft or any of the offices, you've always got a QPR flag hanging from your office. How does that identity kind of play out in your workplace today? Because it's still very important to you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's true. You know, I got some coaching from somebody once who said, you know, that isn't very corporate and you might want to take that stuff down. And the other thing, for those of you who haven't met me, is that, you know, I wear sometimes these beads around my neck. And the analogy I use of myself, in a way, is that it almost gives me a bit of a distinctive humanity, coming back to the role that many of us play as facilitator. You know, and I think in a weird way, you know, if you compare us back to the temples and the palaces, you know, what role do probably the people listening to this podcast right now, what role do we play in society and the organization? And I've always been fascinated by the role of the Joker in many ways, because if you think about the role of the Joker wears the funny costume, the hat, the bells, the things. And in many ways, because of that, because they're saying, hey, look, here's something distinctive about me that isn't part of the typical corporate, it allows me in that moment of humanity, because that I'm choosing what to put on the outside of my wall and I'm decorating a little bit.
Yeah.
It allows me to speak truth to power. I sense, in a way, because it's demonstrating that, and it comes back, it's not exactly being a maverick, but I think it's giving you an element of humanity. It's allowing people to get their guard down by saying, hey, this is something about me that has nothing to do with this corporate space. And I think many of us, and this is myself too, at some points, you know, I remember at one point in my career, I got taken, actually it was by the coach who was doing my barricades to the boardroom speech. She took me shopping a couple of times to Saks in Fifth Avenue to kind of say, you need to dress the part, you know, to be able to present. And there was a message of, I think at that point I was wearing a lot of secondhand suits, you know, trying to be all trendy. Yeah. And I got told, you need to spend some money on clothes to look the part. And I went through that for a little bit in my corporate career. You know, I invested in the kind of Armani suits and all that. And then I kind of rebelled a bit and said, yeah, that's right. But actually, it doesn't feel like me. And I went back to, you know, wearing my beads, putting my QPR flags up. And that was a little bit of my authentic self. So it gives me both a little bit of a grounding in saying, this is who I am. And there's no fear. And actually, because of that, in a strange way, there's more acceptance and more permission. So like my office almost becomes not quite a confessional, but it's amusing and it relaxes and it brings something. You must relate to that as well, because I know when you've come into groups, you often tell a story about your work in the psychiatric wards or your background, and that itself relaxes people and gives them access to you. Yes.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's interesting because when I started working in the big corporates, I was trying to hide all that stuff. And I used to sort of try and be like them. You know, that was what my coach said to me, you know, wear the suit, kind of dress up and be like the other. And then I go to the bar afterwards, or I go to the coffee room, and someone would ask me, and I'd tell them a bit about my background. And they'd be so engaged and so interested. And I learned that was a way in, that's what people were really interested in my experience as a human being, and my experience kind of working with the living and the dying as a nurse and in psychiatry and stuff. So, being distinctively human, I think that's very, very important. I mean, I write quite a lot about the conformist cultures in, not just in corporates, but in the public sector as well. And workplace often tries to conform people to a way of being. And I think hanging on to that distinctive humanity is absolutely essential to our own happiness and well-being, but also for the good of the company.
That's very true. You know, I wonder what that's all about, why there was such that push to have everybody dressed the same. I mean, there's whole industries of fashion that kind of dictated for a long time, dressed to impress and how things need to look like. The judgment of the expense, the cut of cloth, you know, many times, and I'm going to get into gender here, you know, women being taught to power dress to the shopping ads, that you need to almost bulk up. And it's very tribal, isn't it? If you go back to kind of, I often like to go back to the basis of tribal days, you know, the king or the priests or the elders would have more feathers, more beads, more headdress than the common people. And so there was always like, the more feathers I show, the more important I am. And that it's funny how these basic things translate into our boardrooms as well as the reflection I'm having now.
Yeah, I mean, I remember a very funny moment. We're working in one of the big banks, and I was in front of a lot of very senior managers, a room of 50-odd people, and I was doing my talk on leadership and eco-leadership and stuff. And they got to the question time, and I told them my personal story as an introduction. And someone said, "You've come from the public sector, and it's very unusual for someone from the public sector to advise people from the corporate sector. Normally, it's the other way around. We bring in corporate knowledge in it to try and change the public sector." And he said, "What would be your key insight?" And I said to him, "When I worked in a psychiatric asylum, I really noticed how everyone was totally institutionalized. And I walk into your bank and there's an open planned office with 300 people sat there, everybody wearing dark suits, everybody sat, almost silence, just tapping away at the computers. There's rules about speaking." And I say, I notice a very similar institutionalization and I find it very, very worrying. and it is that thing about the rhetoric of public sector and big organizations is about being innovative and about bringing your humanity. And yet there's a flip side, which is we need one company, one culture, all be the same. And I think there's a real tension in organizations and in society around these issues of individuality versus collective conformity. That's what I experience in organizations.
I couldn't agree more. You know, and as we think, I've given a couple of talks recently when I've talked about you know, what's essential for organizations today is that connection and, you know, getting into the whole idea of the fourth industrial revolution and the connectedness of things, that conformity blocks our connectedness in many ways because it's hard to be sticky or connect to another human being who is much more drone-like in many ways in terms of just conformity. And it's much easier to be sticky to another human being when they're individually human because there's something interesting, there's something I attach to them. And in many ways, a lot of the work we do is trying to reintroduce or give permission to people. You know, it's very vogue today to talk about bringing the human back into corporate. And I think a lot of that is just trying to build the humanity in. And I've always been fascinated by sometimes some of the training, the programs that we put on in corporates is to teach people the same skills that they have in other aspects of their life. So in the drive to work at the weekends and the evenings and the mornings, I'm a fully functioning human, able to give feedback, able to give tender love and care, able to react with another human being in the street who's in distress, you know, with huge empathy and love and to be a caring, you know, there's that thing where we stop and we talk to strangers, we engage, all of us do that. And yet we cross the line into the corporate and we somehow feel dehumaned to be able to use the same skills. So it's not that people don't have these skills that often, you know, we're paying consultants or we have the internal team trying to do. It's a matter almost of giving them permission to say, you don't have to have that fear. You can bring that individuality that you already know, that you've learned that lot of skills being in. And so much of this is just permission. And the removal of fear to say you can actually be yourself. And there's a phrase I'm using a lot, which is trying to move from the concepts of pyramids to a galaxy. that so much information flow right now is sort of up and down that pyramid, and there's that kind of fear associated with hierarchy. And instead, we need to be reimagining our organizations as galaxies of light that are connecting to each other. And I think the connection has to be human. We connect to each other when we know each other's interesting stories and backgrounds. And it's about taking the time, again, back to the idea of containment, to actually tell each other our stories and to kind of rehumanize ourselves as individuals, that I think helps with that network ability.
No, I totally agree. I mean, there's lots of complexity in systems thinkers who talk about distributing leadership, et cetera. But I always say you can't distribute leadership until you actually unleash humanity. You have to kind of allow people to, if people are going to take up leadership and be the unique leaders they are and show their unique strength, then they have to kind of be themselves and allow it to shine through in the workplace, exactly as you're saying. So that piece of work has to come first before you can have any grand ideas about unleashing innovation and distributing leadership. You have to kind of unleash humanity first, don't you?
I think so. You have to know each other's stories. And I guess going back to football, you know, that's one of the bonding things that particularly, I mean, I can use the analogy now, particularly the away games, you know, for those of you who've never been to a football match, at least in the UK and I'm thinking across the world, the best days are the away games, because it's a little bit like you're visiting another territory, another place. So on the trip to Manchester, on the trip to Leeds or wherever, you're spending a couple of hours together in a car, on a bus, on a train, and you have nothing else to talk about but each other. And you learn in a relaxed setting to know each other. You have this kind of emotional, you know, spiritual visit of the game, but the game is almost incidental. You get these tremendous, strong tribal bonds between people. And I find myself, I keep going back to that idea of the tribe, but when we used to work together in more, you know, what they might call simplistic societies, if we went, you know, if we went hunter gathering, if we were sitting basket weaving, looking after the kids, building a fence, whatever it was, we spent our time singing songs together. We spent our time talking to each other about whatever else. Some of the greatest wisdom I get in the world. I remember having some people a couple of years in doing decorating for my house. There's three painters in the house. And similar with taxi drivers. And when you listen to people who are doing, say, decorating or painting or driving a taxi, some of the greatest wisdom in the world that I have is actually not from listening to gurus, but it's actually talking to them, because as they're working, they're spending all their time talking about, you know, life and some of the difficult things. And some of the greatest philosophers on our planet are not sitting, in my belief, in academic boardrooms. They're driving taxis, they're building walls, they're painting houses, because they're exercising their humanity and their brains in dialogue all day long. And, you know, and sometimes within this corporate environment, we are encouraging people to sit in silence, to be focused, focused, focused. But we're losing that aspect of dialogue of who we are and allowing, you know, these amazing brains that we have to actually solve problems. I've honestly got some of the greatest wisdom from looking at people where you might least expect it, because they've really dedicated a lot of their working lives to dialogue as opposed to just being task focused.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I often tell a story about when I talk about eco-leadership and distributing leadership. I say that leadership is there, but we just don't notice it, you know. So, you know, I remember being on a bus and the bus driver managing a very, very difficult, probably mentally troubled and aggressive passenger. And the way, the skill and the beauty of the way they managed that situation was just pure leadership in action, you know, and it was done so humanely and just was such a gifted way. But that wouldn't normally be noticed as leadership or as powerful. It's just something which happens. And I think if we kind of pay attention and look awry and look for these moments and learn from them, from each other, I think that's really kind of how we can move forward in organizations and try and enable people to take up leadership, not by following kind of a set of competences, but by being themselves.
I couldn't agree more. You know, one of the fascinating things that I know you've looked at in the last few years has been this idea of emergent leadership. And as we think about the distribution of information, which is what this whole, you know, fourth industrial revolution is all around, many more humans today have access to information I look at my 12-year-old, my 15-year-old. I can throw any question at them and they debate me, but they'll go and research it and look it up and come back with facts and figures and like, Dad, you're wrong, all the time. But one of the things that means is that when we look at social movements and causes, it's coming sometimes from the least expected places because people have information at their fingertips a lot more. And it's how do we, a couple of things, it's how do we encourage that leadership to emerge, which gives a dynamism to the organization, which actually helps organizations solve some of the complex things that it needs to in the most unexpected places, unexpected because it's outside of the traditional hierarchy. And that brings, I think, the agility and the resilience that's getting talked about as desired, but is not released. You know, there's a theme of giving people permission. And when people are realizing it, you know, not squashing it, but actually allowing that kind of humanity to break free. And that, I think, is the answer to how we get to this networked, agile society that we're trying to achieve in organizations.
That's very true, Chris. Really, really nice piece of wisdom. Chris, we're coming to an end. We could go on in many different directions, and I'm sure we'll do this again in 6 months or 9 months. But before we end, I'd like to ask my guests two questions. From this conversation and from your experience, what can you tell our audience about how to live a good life and to create a good society?
Wow.
Big one.
Big one. You know, I think it's actually a big one, but it's small things. I'm going to come back to the golden rule. I've been reading a lot recently about stomach bacteria and how many of our decisions don't come from our brain necessarily, but from the sort of needs of our stomach bacteria. But the point being that, you know, if we feel something, there's that phrase, feel something in our gut about right or wrong. There's a values moment. There's a values moment to what just doesn't sit right with you. Really challenge yourself to do the right thing in small ways every day. And I think if all of us just made the choices to just to do the right thing in the small moments, not in the big acts, but in the small everyday moments, if everybody did that, I think we'd all be in a better place. So speak up, your voice has power. You know, you are worthy, whoever you are. And bring your values to life.
Fabulous. Chris, it's been really wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom. It's been really great.
Pleasure. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like more information about our coaching, training, and events, please contact simon@analyticnetwork.com. or go to www.analyticnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.